listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Welcome to Obesity Chronicles, A Novel Perspective. My name is Robert Kushner, and I'm a professor of medicine and medical education at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and director of the Center for Lifestyle Medicine and Northwestern Medicine in Chicago. This program is intended for healthcare professionals. The information presented in this podcast is aligned with the views and opinions of the speakers and is sponsored by Novo Nordisk. The speakers have been compensated by Novo Nordisk for their participation in this program. This podcast is not to be used as medical advice and is intended for educational purposes only. It is not approved for continuing medical education credits. In today's podcast titled Obesity's Hidden Hurdle, The Science Behind Metabolic Adaptation, we will discuss metabolic adaptation and how it affects weight loss maintenance. At this time, I am pleased to be joined today by Jeff Seacott and Eric Ravison. Jeff, could you introduce yourself to our audience?
Hello. Yes, my name is Jeffrey Seacott, and I'm a physician here in Richmond, Virginia. My background is in endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism, but I've been board certified in obesity medicine for more than a decade, and obesity medicine has been my passion and the focus of my practice for the last 15 years or so. I also do a lot of teaching at the local and national level on obesity medications and the pathophysiology of obesity, which are some of my favorite subjects.
Thanks. Eric?
Hello, I'm Eric Ravison. I'm the Associate Executive Director at Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Pennington Biomedical is quite a unique place where we do only research, mostly on nutrition and obesity. Personally, I've been interested in the phenomenon of metabolic adaptation since the early 1980s, when my Swiss colleagues and I identified during weight loss using a metabolic chamber in Lausanne, Switzerland. By the way, the reason for me to be working in the U.S. is that I was invited by the NIH in the mid-1980s to build the first metabolic chamber in North America. Such room calorimeters allow minute-by-minute accurate and precise measure of daily energy expenditure, including all the components of energy expenditure. Such measures have taught us a lot about inter-individual variability in metabolism. People can have different metabolism even among individuals at the same age, the same sex, the same weight, and the same body composition.
Thank you both. Today, we will discuss the relationship between energy intake, energy expenditure, and metabolic adaptation. We'll also explore how these factors affect weight management, especially in individuals who struggle with their weight. So, Jeff, let's start with you. What is metabolic adaptation? Why is it an important concept to understand to help your patients with overweight or obesity managing their weight?
So metabolic adaptation is a fascinating topic to discuss, and it's so important to understand in the context of weight loss and weight maintenance for our patients with obesity. So metabolic adaptation is the body's physiological response to weight loss due to reduced calorie intake that can ultimately promote weight regain by slowing metabolism or altering appetite-regulating hormones, and thus can be a barrier to maintaining long-term weight management. And so to better understand what that means, let's take a step back and talk about energy balance. So what is energy balance? Energy is just another word for calories. So energy balance means there's a balanced state where calorie intake is equal to calorie expenditure or energy expenditure. And since it is equal, you maintain a certain weight. Calorie intake and calorie expenditure are two factors that really help determine energy balance. And that's explaining energy balance at a very simplified level, because while calorie intake might be easier for some to understand, energy expenditure, that's a really whole different story. It is really hard to know how many calories someone is actually expending and burning. So when your calorie intake increases over your calorie expenditure, you start to gain weight and vice versa. Simply put, when your outs are greater than your ins, that's when you start to lose weight at this simplified level. But as you start to lose weight from eating less calories, your body has this response that enables it to adapt to this lower calorie intake by reducing your energy expenditure increasing your hunger and appetite and decreasing your satiety. This is caused by changes in appetite hormones and a slower metabolism. And as a result, you may start to eat more and regain weight. And really what this means is that when your patient with obesity starts to lose weight, their body tries to adjust its metabolic rate in order to conserve energy and thus reduce the rate of weight loss. So in other words, after weight loss, metabolic adaptation may lead to a decrease in resting metabolic rate, or RMR, and lower energy expenditure, which can also, unfortunately, lead to weight regain. So in the real world, what this means is that while substantial weight loss is possible by following different treatment regimens, sustained long-term weight maintenance can be more challenging. A meta-analysis of 29 long-term weight loss and weight management studies of structured U.S. weight loss programs with greater than or equal to 2 years of follow-up that included samples ranging from 6 to 508 patients aged 31 to 59 years found that individuals maintained 44% of their initial weight loss at 2 years and only 21% at 5 years. We all know patients who have lost a tremendous amount of weight due to calorie restriction, but we also know that a lot of those patients may regain weight, and that is just ultra frustrating overall. One thing that I would emphasize is that when you look at metabolic adaptation, it's not just the drop in metabolism that is expected with weight loss. As Eric has published back in the 80s, one of the biggest predictors of metabolism is lean body mass and skeletal muscle mass. And when we lose a certain amount of lean body mass and muscle, we actually expect that our metabolism will slow down. Now, I'm sure, Eric, that you will get into this topic more later in our discussion as the expert on this topic. The way that I think about it is that what's unique about metabolic adaptation is that it's essentially a greater drop in metabolism than expected. When you lose a certain amount of muscle mass, you expect to decrease your metabolism by a certain amount. But in reality, you lose more than expected. So technically, metabolic adaptation is essentially the difference between the expected metabolic rate that would be calculated versus the truly measured metabolic loss that is seen. And I feel it's important for clinicians to understand this concept so that they appreciate that there's actual physiology that may work against their patients' weight management efforts. And when I'm educating on obesity, this physiology is the aha moment for those who still do not accept obesity as disease. This is when they realize that obesity is disease and not simply a lack of willpower.
Thanks, Jeff, for that really wonderful insight. Eric, we know that you've studied this topic for many decades. Can you tell us about your research and about metabolic adaptation in your own words? How does metabolic adaptation affect one's resting metabolic rate to ultimately affect weight management?
Yes, absolutely. As Jeff mentioned, it is important to understand that we burn a certain amount of calories, and to maintain weight, we need to ingest a similar amount of calories as we burn. Now, how do we burn the calories? I think it's mostly through resting metabolic rate, physical activity, and what we call the thermic effect of food. Indirect calorimetry, which is the measure of both oxygen consumption and carbon dioxide production, has helped us to better understand the components that influence energy metabolism and its role in weight control. This can be better informed in the development of strategies to combat obesity. Let's start with physical activity, which may account for 20 to 30% of total daily energy expenditure, but varies depending on the type and intensity of activity. For example, energy expended for physical activity has been estimated to range from approximately 15% in very sedentary individuals to up to 50% in highly active individuals. Energy burn through physical activity can be through spontaneous physical activity or voluntary physical activity. If I now go outside and walk or jog 2 miles, that is what is called voluntary physical activity. On the other hand, what is called spontaneous physical activity refers to the proportion of daily energy expenditure from sitting, maintaining posture, fidgeting, shopping, and so on. These activities are not typically as physically demanding as voluntary exercise, but they still require a significant level of energy for extended period of time. Then we have the thermic effect of food. When you ingest food, this food is absorbed in the gastrointestinal tract. Then it is transported into the tissue, where it is either oxidized or in most cases stored. The thermic effect of food, which is an increase above your resting metabolic rate of energy expenditure, is really the cost of digestion, absorption, transport, and storage of food. Finally, the third component of your daily energy expenditure is the resting metabolic rate. Resting metabolic rate represents approximately 60 to 70% of your daily caloric budget, while the thermic effect of food represents only 10% of the calories that you burn in a day. And then the rest, about 20 to 30%, is all physical activity, which is either spontaneous or voluntary physical activity. Of course, the contribution of these three components vary quite a bit, and that mostly in relationship to your level of physical activity. For example, if you are in the Tour de France and you burn 6,000 calories a day just in exercise, the resting metabolic rate becomes a much smaller proportion of your total daily energy expenditure. Now, during weight loss, you decrease your energy requirement. You eat less. So when you eat fewer calories, let's say you go from 2,500 to 1,500 calories per day, you have 1,000 fewer calories to process. The first thing is that you already decrease your energy expenditure from the thermic effect of food. In fact, studies have shown that weight loss can lead to a decrease in 24-hour energy expenditure by up to 15% lower than what is predicted after adjustment for changes in body composition. What happens after you have lost, let's say, 10 pounds? After this weight loss, which include mostly fat loss, but also some muscle loss, the energy cost of moving your body, such as climbing the stairs, is decreased. So due to muscle loss, you burn less energy after weight loss compared to before weight loss for the same physical activity level. In addition to physical activity, fat and lean mass also contribute to the third component of your daily energy expenditure, the resting metabolic rate. Multiple studies have shown that losing 9 to 11% of your initial body weight through caloric restriction in healthy, normal weight and overweight individuals can reduce your resting metabolic rate by 7 to 10%. This is basically because your body becomes more efficient in processing the necessary calories it needs to function for everyday activities. And this is what makes the quality of the weight loss important.
Well, I think this is an important concept for us to understand, that when you lose weight, you lose fat mass and lean mass. Can you talk to us a little bit more about this, Eric?
Yes, sure. Body composition changes over time with sustained caloric restriction. Men with obesity typically have more than 25% body fat, and women with obesity typically have more than 35% fat. However, in many patients with severe obesity, body fat can be up to 50% or more of your body weight. Studies have shown that in response to sustained energy restriction, 15 to 40% of weight loss can be lean mass. This contrasts with fat mass loss, which is typically about 60 to 85% of the weight loss. I should also note that most of the lost lean mass is due to a loss of skeletal muscle mass, while other highly thermogenic organs, such as the liver, kidneys, and heart, are minimally impacted during weight loss. Lean mass is metabolically active and burns nearly three times more calories than fat mass. So the loss of muscle mass is one of the main reasons why your metabolism slows down after weight loss. This can make it more difficult to maintain weight loss. Furthermore, after weight loss, most of the weight regain is typically fat mass. As a result, the loss of lean mass and the gain of fat mass can lead to a progressive decline in resting metabolic rate over several weight cycles. This has been often called yo-yo dieting.
Thanks, Eric. So most of us have heard about the reality TV show, The Biggest Loser, a study that was done on 16 contestants from The Biggest Loser show who underwent an intensive diet and exercise intervention and what metabolic adaptation occurred when individuals rapidly lost massive amounts of weight. 14 of these individuals' changes in resting metabolic rate and body composition changes were then observed again 6 years later. From that study, I think I've learned a lot about the persistence of metabolic adaptation. Eric, I know you were involved in this study. Do you want to share some of your thoughts?
Absolutely. The Biggest Loser was a 30-week reality television show of a weight loss competition in which contestants with class 3 obesity raced to see who could lose the most weight. The goal of the competition was to lose as much weight as possible by mostly intensive exercise training. But I must tell you that the weight loss due to increased exercise is not perfectly true, because when you chase a prize of $250,000, you'll do anything to lose the weight, including caloric restriction. My colleague Kevin Hall and I were invited to California to do measurements in participants from the season 11 of The Biggest Loser. 14 of the 16 original contestants, 6 men and 8 women, with a mean age of approximately 35 years, were recruited to participate in a follow-up study that assessed how their weight and RMR changed from the baseline, the start of the competition, to 30 weeks after the start of the competition, and then 6 years after the completion of the competition. As we measured their body composition by dual X-ray absorptiometry, which is the best method to assess small changes in body composition, we followed these people and also measured their metabolic rate as well as collected some blood. At the start of the competition, these 14 contestants had an average weight of 328 pounds, an average body mass index of 49.5, which puts them well into the class 3 obesity range, and an average body fat percentage of 49.3. It is really quite amazing that by the end of the 30-week competition, contestants managed to lose an average of about 129 pounds, bringing the average body weight from 328 pounds at baseline to approximately 200 pounds, or an average body weight reduction of about 39%.
Jeff, can you give us some context from your clinical experience for that rate of body weight reduction?
Sure. You know, to give some context for that 39% body weight reduction, in the field of obesity medicine, greater or equal to 5% body weight reduction is actually considered clinically meaningful. Greater or equal to 10% body weight reduction is actually great, and 20 to 30% is actually the average weight loss achieved with someone having gastric bypass. So really, just to focus, 39% is actually pretty vast, pretty incredible weight loss.
So Eric, what happened to these contestants 6 years after the competition? Were they able to maintain this 39% weight loss?
It turns out that 6 years after the completion of The Biggest Loser, these contestants regained 90 pounds of weight. The 14 contestants started at an average weight of 328 pounds at baseline, and at the end of the competition, they were at an average of around 200 pounds. But 6 years after the competition, they were at an average of 290 pounds. To test the hypothesis that the contestants in the Biggest Loser competition would experience metabolic adaptation, the study first examined changes in resting metabolic rate from the beginning of the competition, which was on average 2,607 kilocalories per day, to the end of the 30-week competition, which measured at an average of 1,996 kilocalories per day, so a drop of an average of approximately 600 kilocalories per day. The Biggest Loser study was unique because the contestants kept more muscle than we would expect to see with this amount of weight loss. So this approximate 600 kilocalories per day reduction is actually lower than we would have expected considering the contestants' body composition. It was predicted on the basis of regression equations that after the end of the 30-week competition, the resting metabolic rate would be reduced from baseline by only an average of 300 kilocalories per day. So it's the delta between the measured decrease in resting metabolic rate, 600 kilocalories per day, and the predicted decrease in resting metabolic rate, 300 kilocalories per day, that represent this metabolic adaptation. Once again, this data shows that weight loss due to decreased calorie intake is accompanied by significant long-term metabolic changes that make the body more efficient at using energy. Now, the most disturbing thing about this, although I will say probably not unexpectedly, 6 years after the competition, participants experienced significant weight regain. Unfortunately, the body remembers your previous baseline weight and tries to bring it back to that spot. 6 years after the competition, you see that pretty much all but one participant experienced significant weight regain. Out of the 14 participants, 5 participants were back within 1% of their baseline weight. But what is interesting is that despite the significant weight regain, the average resting metabolic rate after 6 years was 1,903 kilocalories per day, which remained similar to the resting metabolic rate at the end of the competition and significantly lower than the resting metabolic rate that had been predicted as a function of fat-free mass, fat mass, age, and sex. What are the lessons from this extreme study? First, when people lose weight, we expect their metabolism to go down. We used to assume that when they regain weight, their metabolism would go up. But unfortunately, in this study, as dramatic as it was, contestants experienced extremely rapid weight loss, dropped their metabolism, regained the weight, but did not regain their metabolism. And essentially, 6 years after they lost this tremendous amount of weight, many of them returned to their baseline weight.
Indeed, that is very frustrating for patients when they regain their lost weight. But that's why we try to set realistic expectations based on this kind of data. Jeff, how do you handle this with your patients?
I tell them that obesity is a chronic progressive, we sometimes call it a relapsing disease with recurrence. It needs long-term treatment and vigilance and setting realistic expectations. Indeed, facing this metabolic adaptation that you didn't have before weight loss, you have to compensate for that. And how do we do that? In the beginning of one's weight loss journey, the key to weight loss is usually nutritional changes with a dietary approach that reduces calorie intake. However, as one keeps losing more and more weight, while the nutritional changes remain extremely important, as one loses more weight, then the metabolic adaptation and metabolism reduction start to slow down the weight loss. Thus, it's key to increase physical activity. And in the beginning, it's a good idea to take advantage of any opportunity to increase one's calorie burn. In the earlier ranges of weight loss, this could simply be trying to build in more activity in your regular day, such as taking the stairs instead of the elevator or parking further away in the parking lot. In general, different guidelines have recommended 30 minutes of physical activity a day, 5 days per week, to get about 150 minutes of activity per week. However, the guideline recommendations are different when looking at the amount of physical activity needed to maintain weight loss after someone has already lost weight. The guidelines from the American College of Sports Medicine, the Obesity Society, and the American College of Cardiology recommend that to maintain weight loss in people who have already lost weight, one needs a much higher amount of physical activity, to the range of 40 to 60 minutes per day on average, or 200 to 300 minutes per week, specifically for weight maintenance after weight loss. So really, this is essentially a doubling of the traditional amount of activity that many people have heard of. Thus, my message is that once someone has lost a significant amount of weight already, it may require a very intentional increase in physical activity to help manage their weight. But still, the other side of the energy balance equation is important, which is calorie intake. You cannot totally let it go. And this is why another major reason for weight regain is that we need to control our food and calorie intake. So increasing physical activity, increasing resistance training, and reducing calorie intake are some of the major ways that we can help maintain weight loss.
I would also like to point out that the Biggest Loser competition is a well-known example, but this is not real life. This is not what healthcare professionals are usually dealing with their regular patients who have obesity. As you said, Jeff, this is extraordinary. There are a lot of other studies that research metabolic adaptation. Just going to the Biggest Loser and saying, this is why we know what we know about metabolic adaptation can be misleading. Metabolic adaptation is a universal phenomenon. A study by Dr. Leibel at Rockefeller University in the 1990s found that when people gain weight, their bodies increase their energy expenditure in an attempt to burn off the excess calories. Conversely, when people lost weight, their bodies decreased their energy expenditure in an attempt to conserve energy. The authors also found that these changes in energy expenditure are similar in lean individuals and in individuals with obesity, and suggested that metabolic adaptation, which is the body's tendency to increase or decrease its energy expenditure in response to changes in weight, is a universal phenomenon. In another study in the 1980s, we followed 95 Southwestern American Indians for 2 years and found that those with the lowest 24-hour energy expendititure were more likely, four times as much, to gain more than 15 pounds over the study period than those with high 24-hour energy expenditure. We also found that resting metabolic rate, adjusted for factors such as age, sex, and body composition at the start of the study, was a predictor of how much weight they would gain over the 4 years of the follow-up period. And ever since then, we have been hypothesizing that a low rate of energy expenditure may contribute to familial aggregation of obesity, which is commonly observed in clinical practice. So I would say targeting energy expenditure and preserving lean muscle mass can help provide sustain high-quality weight management.
Eric, thank you for that reminder that metabolic adaptation is a universal phenomenon. Energy expenditure is part of metabolic adaptation, as exemplified by the Biggest Loser study. But it has been shown in many, many studies and observations of weight loss. But there's also a change in energy intake side of the equation that has to do with appetite regulation and hormone changes. So let's focus on that. Eric, what can you tell us about appetite hormone changes as they relate to metabolic adaptation?
Yes, Bob, metabolic adaptation is the body's physiological response to weight loss from reducing calories that can ultimately promote weight regain. One aspect of this physiological response is alteration in appetite hormone, as you just mentioned. Levels of hunger and satiety hormones are altered as a part of the metabolic adaptation process, which can contribute to the weight regain. One study in Australia enrolled 50 patients with BMIs ranging from 27 to 40, of which 34 patients completed the study. These patients achieved initial weight loss with a very low-calorie diet for 8 to 10 weeks. These patients then received counseling from a dietitian for 1 year to maintain this weight loss due to caloric restriction. During the course of the trial, circulating levels of appetite-regulating hormones were measured at baseline, week zero, immediately after the initial weight loss, week 10, and 1 year after the initial weight loss, week 62. The study showed that a year after the initial weight loss, following caloric restriction, you'd still have increased ghrelin compared to baseline, which is the hunger-inducing hormone that promotes food intake, and there was a decrease in satiety-inducing hormone such as leptin, amylin, and glucagon-like peptide 1, or so often called GLP-1. And these hormones are very important for the modulation of appetite, satiety, and therefore food intake, which means that basically now you have two sides of the equations fighting against you, the energy expenditure side and the energy intake side. Fighting against this weight, you have two major mechanisms. One, a metabolic adaptation, which includes profound reduction in energy expenditure. And two, a drive towards increased food intake and decreased satiety. And I think this is one of the reasons why long-term strategies are necessary to counteract this metabolic adaptation to prevent obesity relapse.
I agree. And I think that most of my patients who try to get control of their weight experience this, that despite changes in lifestyle and physical activity, the weight is very, very difficult to keep off. And given their best efforts, weight is not staying off. It's like a metaphorical tug of war between your lifestyle modification, that includes decreased calorie intake and increased physical activity, and the physiological response to weight loss that encourages weight regain, the decreased metabolic rate, increased hunger hormones, and decreased fullness hormones. It is particularly the hunger hormone ghrelin, which triggers appetite increase and signals the brain to drive body weight or body fat mass back to where it was when you started. Anyone who's tried to lose weight more than one or two times in their life has probably experienced this struggle. And we know that it's very important to have a supportive environment and not to do it alone. It's not just a matter of self-discipline, but really about engaging in healthy lifestyle behaviors.
We discussed our patients' daily struggle with chronic weight management. As healthcare professionals or HCPs, we play a critical role in this metaphorical weight management tug of war. The best approach will vary from person to person. However, by addressing and acknowledging the challenges our patients face, we can help them lose weight and keep it off. Jeff, what is the role of HCPs in chronic weight management?
I find it very interesting that when it comes to obesity management, some healthcare professionals expect patients to manage their weight themselves. Throughout the country, obesity is managed at the gym, with dietitians, or with different commercial weight loss programs. Although these are certainly helping to contribute to weight loss management, it is fascinating that obesity as a disease is sometimes not treated within the healthcare office. When you think of the physiology, chronicity, and biological changes that contribute to obesity and can cause the recurrence of weight gain, it makes you realize that this is a disease that often requires comprehensive long-term treatment plans. So I wholeheartedly believe that we as healthcare professionals have an invaluable role in helping our patients with obesity address their weight and help them manage it. When looking at the four pillars of weight loss, as described by the Obesity Medicine Association, which includes number one, nutrition, number two, physical activity, number three, behavior, and number four, medication, three of these pillars can be treated by non-healthcare professionals, but only those able to prescribe medications for chronic weight management, along with comprehensive lifestyle interventions for appropriate patients, can resolve that fourth pillar. So it's very important that we be involved in the process because we know from a meta-analysis that patients receiving healthcare professionals' guidance regarding their weight are nearly four times more likely to attempt weight loss. Data from a randomized control trial show that a brief, even 30-second conversation can make a difference in helping patients manage their weight. So start that dialogue about obesity by asking the patient's permission to discuss weight and offer patients referral to a weight management program and a follow-up appointment.
Based on your clinical experience, what are the key messages that you want to get across to your patients? And how do you broach the topic of obesity when you're seeing a patient who's struggling with their weight?
Because I currently work in a dedicated obesity medicine practice, it is very easy for me to start a conversation about weight since these patients are past the pre-contemplation and contemplation stages and are actively seeking treatment. However, when I was working in my general endocrinology practice, I would have to initiate this conversation. For example, I would review vital signs with the patient and perhaps say, your blood pressure is in the goal range, your pulse is normal, your BMI is a numerical value of your weight in relation to your height and a screening method for weight category. Your BMI is 32, which is in the range of obesity. Is your weight something that you would be interested in discussing today? And it was really amazing to me how many people were very interested in having that discussion.
You know, Jeff, I like that approach, particularly when you medicalize BMI so that you're not startling them or shaming them.
Yeah. And you know what? The first thing to broach the topic is really to ask permission. You can say something like, is this a good time to talk about your weight? Or I've noticed that your hemoglobin A1C has been rising slowly over the last several years. We know that this can be impacted by one's body weight. Is this something that you would be open to talking about right now? So it's really broaching the topic and getting an understanding of their interest in engaging in a conversation regarding weight management.
Yeah, that's really where it starts, isn't it? Because they open the door for you to then go in with all kinds of further assessment, weight history to help develop a personalized treatment plan in particular.
Absolutely. This is part of the shared decision-making. Setting up your office environment with appropriate furniture and tools is also very, very important. There may be a capital expense involved in it, but it's very important to meet the needs of the patients you serve. You want to make sure that they feel comfortable in your office. Also, it's important to use people-first language, such as a patient with obesity or having obesity, rather than an obese patient. When I speak globally, I make it a point to use the word obesity as a noun and not use obese as an adjective. The same goes for the word fat. When speaking with patients, I use the term body fat as a noun, and I actually avoid the term fat alone as I try not to use that terminology such that it can be interpreted as an adjective. And so many of our patients have had negative experiences and emotion around the word fat. And thus, I always to make sure to use that word as a noun. In my experience, following up, staying connected with patients, and getting to really know them has been key. Communication is so important. Using empathetic, non-stigmatizing language is really the underlying theme here. Tailoring follow-up visits and adapting how I communicate based on specific patient needs has been very important for the patient's success. It's certainly not a cookie-cutter process. Where a patient is in their weight management journey is another consideration I take into account when managing patients with obesity. For example, the focus may be on nutrition at the beginning stages, then at a certain point, we may shift the focus to physical activity.
Jeff, could you talk more about tailoring the weight management plan for each patient?
Right. So you should work with your patient to set their individual goals. Like I said, it's not cookie cutter. In fact, both the National Institute of Health and the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology and American College of Endocrinology guidelines recommend that clinicians work with their patients to help develop appropriate and realistic weight loss goals based on their patient's weight and comorbidities history. Some patients are good at certain aspects of managing obesity, but struggle with others. There are many factors that need to be considered, so it's important that we as healthcare professionals are reaching into our toolbox of interventions that we can use to individualize obesity management as needed. These individualized weight loss goals should be realistic, appropriate, specific, and attainable. For example, every morning I will wake up 20 minutes earlier and take a walk instead of I will be more active or I will exercise more. Sometimes it helps to list short-term and long-term goals separately. Short-term goals help patients get closer and closer to the ultimate goal. Using specific dates can help motivate patients to commit to their plan. It's amazing how well patients can do when they have something very specific to work towards. There are a lot of tools available to help patients stick to their weight management goals. These tools can be used as a starting point for tailoring each plan to individual patient needs and clinical goals. Self-monitoring of food intake, weight, physical activity with a food and activity journal or an app can be valuable. An example of a weight loss goal for some patients would be 5 to 15% weight loss or more. And we can motivate our patients by educating them of the potential impact this amount of weight loss can have on weight-related complications, such as type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and dyslipidemia.
I think it's really hearing your patient's journey, hearing their pathway, other multiple causes that lead their gaining weight or having difficulty taking it off. You know, whether it's environmental, psychosocial, behavioral, a lot of things we talked about from a biological point of view, but we also have to understand the community they live in and where they work, where they play, and all the barriers. So you really kind of assess when you're taking a history, assemble all that information. You assemble all of it in your mind, then come up with an individualized plan for that patient. Of course, principles of energy balance, self-monitoring, increased physical activity, and so on will be similar. But how do we actually deliver that, and what treatments we use in a specific way are really tailored to the patient?
Exactly.
Jeff, what are the different options available for people with obesity who are struggling to manage their weight? What is the recommended approach to weight management by national medical societies?
Multiple national medical societies from diverse fields, including obesity. That's the Obesity Society, Obesity Medicine Association, American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, Cardiology, American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, Endocrinology, American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, American College of Endocrinology, American Diabetes Association, the Endocrine Society, Pediatrics, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and others, including the Veterans Affairs and Department of Defense, have emphasized the need for a holistic, comprehensive weight management approach to managing obesity that includes comprehensive lifestyle interventions, pharmacotherapy in addition to lifestyle interventions, and even surgery as needed for appropriate patients. Lifestyle modifications such as healthy eating and regular physical activity are the foundation of any weight management plan. However, for many people with obesity, lifestyle modifications alone may not be enough to achieve and manage their weight. And weight management does not always end there. They all support the use for pharmacotherapy along with lifestyle interventions for chronic weight management for appropriate patients. Guidelines also recommend surgery, which is a proven option for more severe obesity or obesity associated with lots of complications. It's important to note that weight management is a long-term process that requires commitment and support. A holistic and comprehensive weight management plan should be tailored to the individual's needs and weight goals.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Eric. Now, before we close the program, let's recap some key points that we discussed today. We talked about the important concept of metabolic adaptation and why patients struggle with weight regain. We talked about what's going on the calorie intake side and the changes that occur with appetite hormones during weight loss due to caloric restriction that can cause decreased satiety and increased appetite. We also talked about how to translate that information to patient care with the communication we use, in the words we use, and how to individualize patient treatment. And by having that physiological background and clinical skills, we can be more helpful by assisting patients get control of their weight and maintain that weight loss the best they can. Jeff and Eric, thank you so much for participating in this program today. And thank you to our audience for joining us for our discussion today.
Robert and Eric, thank you so much for this opportunity to participate in this conversation. And I'd like to give a very special thanks to all the attendees out there for taking the time to listen to this podcast. So thanks again.
And thank you, both of you, for this very interesting discussion and important discussion about the weight relapse in many of our patients with obesity.
This concludes this episode of Obesity's Hidden Hurdle, the science behind metabolic adaptation. Please join us for the next episode of Obesity Chronicles, a novel perspective where we will further explore the topic of obesity as a chronic progressive disease. For more information, please visit rethinkobesity.com, Novo Nordisk is a registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. All other trademarks, registered or unregistered, are the property of their respective owners. Copyright 2023 Novo Nordisk, all rights reserved, US 23OB00219, December 2023.